Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Paris Schutz.
And I'm Brandis Friedman. On the show tonight...
The fact that the Republicans are moving further and further to the right is not my fault.
Illinois' governor has plans for the future, but first he has to secure a second term. One-on-one with J.B. Pritzker.
Plus, we'll talk with a number of other winners in yesterday's primary election contests.
Our Spotlight Politics team digests last night's primary results and looks ahead to November.
I'm Angel Ito, and coming up tonight, I'll share how Chicagoans are wearing pieces of the city, literally.
But first, some of today's top stories. The votes are in, but not all that many from Chicagoans. Just 20.1% of registered Chicago voters participated in yesterday's primary, which is the lowest total since 2014, which saw a little over 16%. 65 to 74-year-olds turned out in the highest numbers with more than 62,000 votes. The lowest, 18 to 24-year-olds, with just under 11,000 votes. Stay tuned in to hear from some of last night's winners throughout the program. R&B singer R. Kelly sentenced today to 30 years in prison for sex trafficking and racketeering. A federal judge in New York told him that, quote, although sex was certainly a weapon that you used, this is not a case about sex. It's a case about violence, cruelty, and control. This ruling comes decades after allegations of his abuse of young girls first circulated in the 90s, as well as an acquittal on similar charges in 2008. Kelly is scheduled to stand trial again in Chicago on August 15th, where he faces additional charges of child pornography and obstruction of justice. Google is reportedly in talks to buy the Thompson Center. That's according to real estate information company CoStar. It's an interesting twist for both the building, which has myriad mechanical issues and has been a candidate for demolition, as well as the Loop, which is an area in need of a business boost. The tech giant would potentially expand its Chicago offices into a large portion of the building's soon-to-be-renovated office space. Any deal on the table is not finalized at this point. Up next, one-on-one with Governor J.B. Pritzker. Stay with us.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
One of Governor J.B. Pritzker's most vocal critics throughout the COVID pandemic is now his general election opponent. Pritzker easily won the Democrats' nomination for governor last night and has his sights set on a second term. But first, he has to beat State Senator Darren Bailey, the downstate farmer who beat a crowded field to win the GOP nomination. Amanda Venicky sat down with Pritzker this morning, and she joins us now with some highlights from that conversation. Amanda, what do you have to say?
Well, Brandis, at first, Democrats do dominate state government, so that gives Pritzker a built-in advantage. Plus, he comes in with the power of incumbency and therefore also name recognition. And Pritzker has no limits on the cash he can spend to win this race. He's heir to the Hyatt fortune. Still, he appears to be taking the general election matchup seriously, coming out swinging against Bailey.
Well, certainly my opponent in the general election for governor is an extremist right-wing Trump MAGA Republican. And so that's something that people need to know, and know that when they go to the polls, they'd be voting for a guy who believes in the same things that Donald Trump believes in. Donald Trump, of course, is a racist, homophobic, xenophobic, misogynist. And, and Darren Bailey sought out his endorsement.
Sought out and won Trump's endorsement. While that may have helped Bailey in the GOP primary and its conservative base, look for Pritzker to use that against Bailey leading up to November. After all, Trump twice lost in Illinois and not by slim margins. Now, that's likely why Pritzker and his allies, in a roundabout, though nonetheless obvious way, helped to prop up Bailey throughout the primary. According to the campaign for Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin, Pritzker's campaign, the Democratic Governors Association, and the state party collectively spent almost $30 million, often on ads categorizing Bailey as too conservative. Now, again, that is a word that resonates with Republican voters. So I asked Pritzker, if it's misogynistic, homophobic, why did you help Bailey? Pritzker repeatedly denied that this campaigning did Bailey any favors.
We worked against all the Republicans. I mean, listen, I'm a Democrat. I want Democrats to win. I wanted to make sure that people knew in the general election that these folks are extremists, that they don't align with the views of the majority of people in the state.
But you didn't have to do that during the primary. You didn't have to do that during the primary, per se, did you?
I'm running against the Republicans. You're saying that the starting gun doesn't start until today?
You don't believe that your money helped to bring name ID to Darren Bailey when he didn't have any campaign funding? You don't believe that you helped to elevate his candidacy?
Republicans voted for their nominee for governor. He didn't just get, you know, a plurality. He got 57%. That means Republicans across the state decided that they wanted to go with the Trump-backed right-wing extremists.
With $30 million or so from UDPI DGA.
Do you know how much money was spent by the other people who were supporting candidates in that right-wing, you know, cabal of a Republican, you know, nomination process? I simply was running my general election campaign. The messages that I was putting out there about candidates and the DGA was putting out there about candidates were really all about just what do the Republicans stand for? They don't stand for the things that you and I stand for.
What role do you believe, if any, you have played in the polarization of politics?
Look, I've worked together to get bipartisan things done in Springfield. I think you know that, getting the cannabis bill passed in a bipartisan way, making sure that we passed the infrastructure bill in a bipartisan way. My first budget, which was the reversal of Bruce Rauner's failures in a budget, we had bipartisan support for. The fact that the Republicans are moving further and further to the right is not my fault. That is something happening within the Republican Party, and it's being led by Donald Trump, and I'm going to be working against that because we need to move toward the middle. We all need to be working together to get things done.
By the way, Pritzker there asked the question, do you know how much money was used on these, quote, right-wing candidates? We do know some of that. Bailey's campaign had tens of millions of dollars in support from another billionaire, Dick Uihlein, while Irvin's campaign, losing campaign, benefited from $50 million from Ken Griffin. Now, nonetheless, Bailey's success and his early motions to otherwise try to take over the state GOP has left moderate and anti-Trump Republicans in Illinois feeling forsaken. I asked the governor if he will do anything to appeal to them. Does he have a business agenda that would perk the ears of more business-minded Republicans, particularly in light of Illinois losing corporations like Caterpillar and Boeing?
Republicans and Democrats voted for that. I worked together to get data center tax credits, and now we've got almost $13 billion of new data centers being built in the state of Illinois, again, done in a bipartisan fashion. So Republicans who see their party moving further to the right should understand that I am trying to bring business, bring jobs, come together with Republicans to get big things done, again, to create jobs and grow business.
I mentioned Bailey making moves to gain power. He's not the only one. Pritzker has been doing the same with the Democratic Party, making endorsements and spending cash on select races for state legislators, also the Democratic State Central Committee. That's the group that steers the state party and the group that will decide if Democratic Party of Illinois Chair Robin Kelly gets to keep that job. So I asked Pritzker, what is behind his making plays in those races?
I want the Democratic Party to represent all of our Democrats and make sure that we're electing Democrats up and down the ticket. I want it to be successful at fundraising. I want us to be grassroots-oriented, knocking on doors all across the state. No part of the state left out. This isn't a party that belongs only in one region. We ought to be winning in central Illinois and southern Illinois. Nikki Budzinski will win in her congressional race because she is a Democrat standing up for people in central Illinois. I believe that these races, the Democrats, when we run and tell people what we stand for, we will win. But we need a strong Democratic Party in order to
Any new chair, however, for the Democratic Party? Do you have somebody in mind?
No decisions have been made about that. I mean, we have already come together as a party around a coordinated campaign to help get Tammy Duckworth reelected, to help get me reelected, all the constitutional
officers. Are you exploring this, though, a new chairperson?
Again, we want to be able to raise money. We want to be able to organize our party in a way that elects more people.
Has not been doing that well enough?
We'll all be talking about that in the next few weeks, no doubt.
Now, Pritzker openly touting his successes of his first term, as you heard him mention. That includes a boost in the minimum wage statewide, protection of the right to abortions, also the legalization of marijuana, though promises of bringing more people of color into that industry. Well, that's been problematic. Also, that huge infrastructure bill that passed with bipartisan support. Pritzker says that sort of negotiating is going to get tougher as the GOP does move to the right. Now, as for what is on target if he wins re-election in November, here's his response.
Well, as you know, we've gotten a lot done, and there's more to do. I'll just give you one example. I believe that everyone who wants to go to college, whether it's community college or university, ought to be able to go to college for free if they make median income or below. We're almost there. We've expanded our MAP grants by 50%. Everybody that is eligible for a MAP grant today is finally getting one. That was never the case before. So we have more to do to make college even more affordable. That's just one example.
And that is the first time that we have heard from Pritzker about these plans for free college. He's got a good 5 months of campaigning to keep his current job, but Pritzker has received national attention about a possible promotion, getting mentioned as a potential candidate for the White House. So I asked Pritzker, does he have his sights set on the presidency?
I'm focused on re-election as governor. I intend to serve 4 years as governor. And I'm, you know, excited about the work that we've gotten done already and plan to do much more in the next 4 years.
So far this cycle, Pritzker has put $90 million into his campaign fund. 4 years ago, he spent more than $171 million on the governor's race. It is a new dynamic here in this race, though. The state budget, yes, going to again be a top issue in the race between Pritzker and Bailey, but so too are cultural issues, things like abortion, what children are taught in schools, and so on. Now, Brandis, I should mention that we did reach out to the campaign for the GOP nominee for governor, of course, Darren Bailey. His team did not return our request. So with that, back to you.
Amanda, thank you. And of course, we'll see you a bit later on in the program. But first, State Representative Delia Ramirez won the Democratic primary in the newly drawn 3rd Congressional District, which is predominantly Latino and includes the Humboldt Park and Logan Square neighborhoods, but also stretches west of the city to include suburbs like Elgin and Bensonville. Joining us now is the Democratic nominee for the 3rd Congressional District, Delia Ramirez. Representative, thank you so much for joining us. You've said that your win is a victory for the Latino community. Your husband, who has Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Protections, or DACA, was unable to vote for you. Tell us how important immigration reform is to you and how you plan to move the needle on that.
Certainly. I mean, there are not too many members of Congress, and I actually don't know any who are in a mixed status. And what I've said during the campaign is that running for this particular district in this moment is personal to me. When it comes to immigration, it's extremely personal. He walked in with me to the polling location. He stood right next to me, and we both fought tears because he couldn't vote for his wife, right? He's been here since he's 14. So for me, when I think about a comprehensive immigration reform, it's about Bodies and the 2 million dreamers, but it's also about their parents and others who, for one reason or the other, didn't qualify as DACA recipients. And it's the right thing to do for our economy. It's also the moral right thing to do. So we've all been talking about comprehensive immigration reform. Some of those things that we could be doing right now is to move that needle is reducing the backlog for all of these cases of people who have been waiting literally 5-6 years to begin their process into a pathway of residency. That's one of those. The other is reducing the cost for residents to become citizens. In some cases for people there, and I knocked on doors and I heard people say, I would love to vote for you. Unfortunately, I'm not a citizen yet. And in many cases, they said to me, I'm not a citizen because I can't afford the application fee. So there's a lot of those things that we could be doing while we move to a full comprehensive immigration reform.
So you have some other priorities as well, the environment, Medicare for all. How does your experience in Springfield help you with those issues?
I ran 5 years ago on healthcare, housing, and education, and I was a proud sponsor of a bill that expanded healthcare coverage initially for seniors in 2020 at the peak of COVID. Last year, for anyone 55 and older, regardless of legal status, and as of July 1st, here in this state, the first in the entire country, if you're 42 years of age and you're eligible for Medicaid, regardless of legal status, you'll get access. Being able to be the lead negotiator and sponsor of this kind of legislation in Illinois that brings more than 54,000 people in this state into healthcare for the very first time is exactly the kind of work that I want to be able to build upon when I get to Congress.
You've characterized yourself as a grassroots candidate. You were endorsed by the progressive elected officials, including both Representatives Jesus Chuy Garcia, as well as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Progressive candidates did well last night. What do you think that means for the candidates who are facing criticism for supporting criminal justice reform and defunding the police?
I think last night was a clear indication that we cannot walk back the work that we have done for criminal justice reform. And what voters in DuPage, suburban Cook, and Cook County said is that we need someone that actually works on the solutions and investments in making communities safe. Look, I won in DuPage with a 47-point lead, despite of the fact that my opponent decided that the one thing that he was going to hit me on day in and day out was about my record on investments in community and police accountability. It didn't work. So what this means for Anthony Quesada, who right now is sitting as the Democratic nominee, as a Democratic socialist, who has talked about what it actually means to defund police, like investing in corresponder models, investing in police training, in violence prevention programs, is that he, in a five-way race, just won with a 14-point lead, and every single person that was on the bottom, under me in the ballot. We all won. We all won as a slate. So instead of talking about fear mongering, I think what Democrats we learned last night, we have to actually start talking about the solutions and making sure we actually have evidence-based programming that gets to violence prevention and the root causes of violence.
You'll face off against Republican Justin Bureau in the general election in November. Do you plan to continue with grassroots fundraising with no corporate PAC contributions?
Absolutely. So I'm taking this evening off, although I'll be doing a thank you for staff in my backyard in about an hour. I'll take Thursday and Friday, but come Tuesday, I get back on those phones. We're going to have our first fundraiser within the first month. We did more than 25 fundraisers. We raised $730,000 with no corporate PAC contributions, and less than $30,000 of that came from labor. Our community put ownership into this campaign, and we won, despite of the fact that my opponent outraised me. We beat him with 40-point lead, and it wasn't just Roe versus Wade. What you saw yesterday down that slate is that people in the state, on that ballot, they voted for good government and against political corruption. They are calling and demanding the kind of Democrat that's transparent, authentic, relatable, and gets things done.
Okay, State Representative Delia Ramirez, the Democratic nominee for the 3rd Congressional District. Thank you so much for joining us. Congrats on your win last night, and good luck in November.
Thank you.
And again, Delia Ramirez will face Republican Justin Bureau in the November election. Now to Amanda and the race for Illinois Attorney General. Amanda.
Thanks, Brandis. As we continue to get to know some of the winners from yesterday's primary, we move to the race for Illinois Attorney General. Republican Tom DeVore won and is looking to replace incumbent Kwame Raoul, who is seeking re-election. DeVore, an attorney, has been behind several lawsuits against the state over mask and other COVID mandates, leading to some tough words from the governor. Take a listen.
He's a grifter who is taking money from parents who are, being taken advantage of. We are trying to keep kids and parents and grandparents and teachers and everybody that's in the community where of the school safe. That's my job as governor. That's our job as elected officials. And I have to say that, that going around and suing school districts and the governor and the attorney general and everybody else in order to keep people less safe, that makes zero sense to me.
Joining us now to discuss this and his vision for the Illinois Attorney General's office is Tom DeVore. Thanks so much. Congratulations. Now, harsh words from the governor there. What was it about COVID that so inspired your ire and your desire to run for this office?
Well, again, when we say what was it about COVID, it wasn't necessarily COVID specifically. It was about an executive officer who was using fear to intimidate people and to exercise and wield power from that office that our Constitution nor our statutes never allowed for. That's what it was about. You know, the governor tried to take every opportunity to accuse me of making people less safe. But what the governor never talked about is who's going to keep the people safe from tyrannical executives. You know, that's really the bigger issue in the long run. And as to the issue of safety, the governor argued for days back in February that if those mandates were lifted, how people were going to be less safe. And guess what? The courts lifted those mandates and nobody was less safe. It was all fear-mongering tactics by the governor, and it didn't work.
And so, Mr. DeVore, there was a bit of an uneven success rate with those lawsuits. You succeeded in the case that led to schools, the elimination of the mask mandate for schools, but other suits failed, and some of your critics have called them frivolous, not just the governor, by the way. So do you have the legal chops to be attorney general, the state's top legal officer?
Well, you know, that propaganda that you just threw out there, I'm glad you did, because, again, they don't know the statistics. You probably don't know, nor did the people that push that propaganda out, would they ever say to you that we won 13 cases in a row when it dealt with the governor's mitigations. And so if you look at our overall record, and again, this is not about records of how many cases were won, how many were lost. We won a whole lot more cases than we lost, but the governor would never tell the people of the state of Illinois about those. He only wanted to talk about the ones that went his way. But overwhelmingly, they went in favor of the people. And again, as of recent, the last 12 or 13 cases in a row were successful against the governor's mandates.
Out of how many cases?
Again, I'm going to spitball here and say there were probably total cases, there were less than 20, and the last 10 to 12 of them, we won every one of them. Starting in August of 2021 until February, we won every case that dealt with mask and exclusion policies that we had.
And Mr. DeVore, does that anti-lockdown message hold up come November? Things have changed. There aren't mandates right now.
Well, there's not mandates right now because the governor's in the middle of an election. And he's trying to pander to people. But I have been across this state for 2 years defending people. Hundreds and hundreds of business owners had their lives ruined. Tens of thousands of children had their educational opportunities permanently inhibited. The mental health of children has suffered dramatically. Those emotions and those real costs are not going to go away. The governor can try all he wants to sweep it under the rug between now and November, but I don't think it's going to work.
I'm guessing you're not going to let him. Now, you did write on your Facebook page, "I've never been labeled a Trump conservative by anyone that actually knows me." So I want to clarify here, what brand of Republican are you? What are your thoughts on Trump?
Well, again, I voted for President Trump, but this whole stigma of a Trump conservative, I don't even really know if people want to be intelligent and articulate that to me, what it means. You know, I'd like to hear it. Those words, you know, they breathe a lot of fire, but what does it really mean? Anybody that's known me my whole life probably finds me to be a really moderate Republican, believe it or not. And to say that I'm some fire-breathing right-wing conservative, people that know me laugh about that because they don't know anything about me.
Never seen any fire breathing, but now I do want to get back to, in terms of Trump, obviously lots of people paying attention to these hearings in Washington, D.C. Do you believe that Trump committed any illegal acts on January 6th?
Again, I'm not in that case. I'm not following those committee hearings. You know, when you ask a lawyer whether somebody committed any illegal acts, I leave that up to the process. For me to start jumping in and saying, yes, he did or no, he didn't, that's just fodder for people to start, you know, throwing about recklessly. So I will leave that up to the committee. I will leave that up to those that are involved in that process to determine whether or not he committed illegal acts. I don't use those words lightly on either side of that conversation.
So a case that you should know something about, you have been named in a federal lawsuit that accuses you of breaking into an office and stealing $20,000 worth of guns, coins, and other items on behalf of a client. Did that happen? Can you explain?
It did not happen at all. My client is a bank. And that bank had a replevin order to go in and take all of the property of this individual. And that property was taken by the sheriff's department and by the bankruptcy trustee. I didn't take anything. It's completely ridiculous. And there was actually an agreement with the gentleman that filed that case. His lawyer made an agreement with the bankruptcy court to, for those things to be taken. And then after they were taken, when the bankruptcy court couldn't come to an agreement with that lawyer, Mr. Walsh fired his old lawyer, hired a new lawyer, and sued everybody.
Mr. DeVore, I'm sorry, we're running out of time. Wanted to make clear that case is still ongoing?
Yeah, the case is still ongoing, but it's frivolous. It's not going anywhere.
Once again, congratulations to you. I'm not sure. I can't tell if you're wearing short sleeves. If so, as we bid our goodbyes, could you hold up your sleeves or your tattoos?
I'm not wearing short sleeves.
Bummer. Yeah. Next time.
If you want to see one, there's freedom right there.
Well, thank you again for joining us, Mr. DeVore.
You're welcome. All right, bye.
There is more Chicago Tonight just ahead, so stick around.
We've made it.
Justice Jackson's appointment to the Supreme Court provides a beacon of hope.
Black women are underrepresented. We still rise. We still show up for one another.
It's us investing in the next generation and giving them something to enrich the next generation with.
And still to come on Chicago Tonight, we talk with Cook County Assessor Fritz Kagi, who is one step closer to a second term after last night's primary victory. And Darren Bailey wins the GOP primary for governor, taking on incumbent J.B. Pritzker in November. As you've heard, our Spotlight Politics team will dish on that and more from last night's elections. But first, some more of today's top stories. Governor Pritzker signed into law a bill that protects Illinoisans against hair discrimination. The Crown Act codifies protections for Illinoisans against discrimination due to hairstyles historically associated with specific racial groups. One study from Dove found that black women are 1.5 times more likely to be sent home from the workplace because of hair. In 2021, Illinois passed the Jet Hawkins Act, which banned hairstyle discrimination in schools. This new law expands the protection to situations under the Illinois Human Rights Act, like employment housing and public accommodations. Chicago's bike lanes are getting an upgrade. All of Chicago's protected bike lanes will be bounded by a concrete curb by the end of 2023. That's according to the Chicago Department of Transportation. This after 5 pedestrians and cyclists have been killed by drivers in the city this month alone, 4 of them children. The city plans to upgrade 15 miles of existing protected lanes and add 10 new miles by the end of the year. Work is set to begin on all this week. And it could be a busy weekend at O'Hare and Midway. The airports are expecting more than 1.6 million travelers between tomorrow and early next week for the 4th of July holiday weekend. O'Hare could see an increase of about 17% over this same period last year, and Midway is anticipating an almost 37% increase. Chicago Department of Aviation recommends that flyers arrive early and be aware of construction, especially at O'Hare's Terminal 5. Cook County Assessor Fritz Kagi faced some headwinds from Chicago commercial building owners and trade union representatives, but he was able to fight off challenger Kerry Steele, winning 53% of the vote. In November, he will go head-to-head against Libertarian candidate Nico Tsatsoulis. And joining us now to talk about his victory and his plans for a possible second term is Fritz Kagi. Assessor Kagi, congratulations to you. Welcome back to Chicago Tonight. As we mentioned, this was a very hard-fought battle between you and Kerry Steele. She was backed by building trades unions and building owners and managers. What do you think put you over the top?
Well, I think this was the voters really recognizing what was at stake. You know, it was the voters and the public that said, we want a vision, a reform vision for this office 4 years ago. And they liked the results, and they saw that something was a little bit off about my opponent's campaign. And then as people started to find out, they realized that, hey, these are the big building owners who are really putting this candidate forward. funding the campaign. And they saw that the interest of these big building owners was really to have bring favoritism back, have lower valuations on their buildings so they could stick homeowners and small businesses with their tax bills. And people said, you know what? We don't want to go back to that. We don't want that kind of favoritism again. We like the results that we're seeing.
And you've been charged with putting some balance into this system here, which in the past under your predecessor favored those big, wealthy commercial property owners at the expense of lower income homeowners. It was a regressive system by every major study that was done on it. But those commercial property owners do complain about, in some cases, assessments that have gone way up, as much as 300%. What is your message to them as they are stuck with you, at least for one more assessment cycle?
Well, the thing is that if you look at the headlines of the trade press, like Crane's Chicago Business, you can see that there's headline after headline of major purchases happening, of big buildings going forward, of transactions happening. We have a healthy economic environment. We don't have to have favoritism for that to happen. And it's not fair to stick the public with their property tax bills for that favoritism. They're not entitled to these special subsidies that no one else gets. My message to them is, look, the public has rejected that vision of the future. They might have tolerated some of this favoritism in the past under Joe Berrios, but they're not having that anymore. People are facing the problems of inflation, of all the economic challenges. They've seen wealth stripped out of their communities, and they just will not go back. So what we can have is a path forward that involves fair and transparent valuations for big buildings while we still have a healthy investment environment. But the bigger buildings will be paying their fair share in the costs of government. And we're not going to be sticking average people, small businesses, with the big tax bills that should have been paid by these bigger buildings all along.
Well, it's not just the big buildings, although there are some smaller business owners, smaller commercial property owners that themselves have complained that their assessments have gone way up. And maybe not necessarily saying that it's not warranted, given how out of whack things were in the past. Is there a way to blunt the blow for them going forward?
Well, actually, small businesses are in a very different boat from the big commercial properties. You know, there are some small commercial properties in the neighborhoods that did have assessments go up, but a lot of those are ones that were getting huge reductions for vacancy. And these properties were kept empty for years, for decades, by out-of-town business owners. Often it's called land banking, and they were stashed. And their assessments went up because we're not going to be giving big rewards for vacancy anymore. That's our policy. But what it does is it takes some of the burden off of the small businesses that are staying open. And if you look at the data, actually small commercial properties in the neighborhoods, their values went up less than the big buildings downtown. And in many neighborhoods, places like Englewood, but also neighborhoods on the north side, smaller commercial is actually going to be bearing a little bit less of the burden, which means their bills are on track to be going down. So it's different. I think the thing that everyone needs to remember is that we're all in the same boat, in the sense that we are all part of one big tax base. And if we can make sure that all property owners are fairly valued, having full values on their properties, that reduces rates for everyone, that benefits small businesses and homeowners alike.
In your candidate forum, when you were on here with your opponent, Kerry Steele, we brought up some hiccups in your first term. Most recently, these late property tax bills being sent out. What is the culprit for those late bills?
Well, I think this was an instance of some of those big building owners trying to turn a positive into a negative. It was their strategy to raise doubts. What we did is we replaced a prehistoric computer system that was over 40 years old. I mean, the viewers out there, it's kind of embarrassing when you have a five-year-old phone. Try running America's largest property tax system on a system that dates to the Atari and predates the Post-it note, and resulted in lots of errors. Only a couple of elderly programmers who even knew how to program on it. Very expensive and very risky. So we followed the county's plan to replace that system. And we're really delighted. You know, part of the news yesterday was that there are two new members of the board review who are elected. And as part of their platform, they're committed to doing technological cooperation with the assessor's office, more sharing of data and more working together and transparency. So I think this kind of cooperation will make sure that we don't have delays when we have technology modernization anymore.
And finally, Assessor, should you go on to beat your Libertarian opponent in the general, what is your vision for the second term?
Well, for the second term, we want to continue to eliminate whatever inequities remain in the process. You know, we've noticed that some commercial properties where we reduced the disparity, the lower valuations through making sure that they're valued in line in the market, sometimes appeals at the board review or other venues are being reducing those values again. We want to make sure that we're working better together using data so that full value is reflected in the largest properties. You know, one of the communities where this happened was in Cicero, where we saw big reductions in the values that we'd raised by these other venues on properties owned by Walmart, by Amazon, by Exxon. These are some of the wealthiest corporations in the world, and we should not be putting more burdens on the backs of hardworking homeowners and small businesses in places like Cicero just because the property tax lawyers have figured out how to rig data to get those values reduced again on appeal. So that's one of the most important objectives for the second term. The other thing we're doing is we're working to reduce assessments on homes at the bottom end of the price spectrum by working with the top 15 assessors' offices in the country, trying to get access to federal mortgage appraisal data that'll give us more information about interior condition and quality, which we don't see right now. And that information could help us make sure assessments are fairer at the bottom end of the price spectrum and give people money.
All right, Assessor Kagi, a lot of work left to do. Congratulations again on your primary victory, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Paris. Appreciate it.
And up next, our Spotlight Politics team takes a closer look at the results of the Illinois primary election, so please stay with us.
Don't ever miss Chicago Tonight. Subscribe to our podcast. Get a daily download of our show delivered to your desktop or mobile device. Go to WTTW.com/Chicago Tonight Podcast and subscribe.
And now with much more on last night's primaries and how the key races are shaping up for November, we're joined by our Spotlight Politics team. We'll also get their take on yet more explosive revelations from the January 6th hearings in Washington. Here with all that and more, Amanda Venicky, Heather Sharone, and Paris Schutz. So, everybody, we know that Darren Bailey, was endorsed by President Trump in the final days of the campaign. He handily defeated Jesse Sullivan, Richard Ervin, and some others to get that GOP nomination. Paris, how do Pritzker and the Democrats view Bailey as an opponent?
They view him as the person they wanted to run against in this general election. You heard in that interview with Amanda earlier, Pritzker spent millions, some interests associated with Pritzker spent millions to help Richard Ervin, who had initially been seen as potentially the front runner, help kind of sink him and elect Darren Bailey. The question is this going to be a good bet come November? It seems like it probably will be. Pritzker has made the point over and over. He's too conservative for Illinois, Bailey, that is. And if you look at the last two, three decades in Illinois, he is too conservative based on who has won state office as a Republican. It's tended to be more moderate, especially on the social issues. That's not Darren Bailey. So it'll be very interesting to see whether Bailey wants to tack a little bit to the center on those social issues, or if he says, you know, my brand has been to be that conservative firebrand. It wouldn't really make much sense. I wouldn't look authentic if I did that. But, you know, there's a long time between now and November. We don't know what's going to motivate voters in the general election. We don't know what inflation is going to be, what the economy is going to be, and what the thinking of independent voters are going to be. So I would assume that Pritzker is not taking this challenge lightly, even though this is the candidate he wanted to face.
Now, Bailey pitches himself as a regular Joe, a family farmer battling out-of-touch elites. Here's a little bit of that pitch from last night's victory speech.
And now the elites and the press say that Pritzker's a shoe-in. You get it. They say our fate's set. That a farmer can't beat a billionaire. Friends, the funny thing is, these same people said that we couldn't win the primary.
Amanda, do you think that is a message that will fly with Illinois voters?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure who said he couldn't win the primary. Frankly, I had thought from a ways back that he had the most solid chance of getting the GOP nomination. I do think, though, that this is a message that sits well with people. He says, I have to balance my family's budget. So do you. Why can't the state? Now, of course, Pritzker would fight back with that and say, Illinois has seen its credit ratings boosted and does have a balanced budget. Nonetheless, we do want to point out he is, yes, a farmer. We don't yet have copies of Bailey's tax returns, nor do we know that those will be released, but it's not quite a small farm. I mean, this is an agribusiness with various components, so it's not like he is a small farmer. I do think, though, that he represents a very big chunk of Illinois. I mean, you look at the map of where Pritzker, where Democrats have won, it is in Cook County, in sometimes the collar counties, making inroads. But the rest of the state really tends to go red. There is a belief that central downstate Illinois are forgotten. And I think that Bailey very much feeds into that. And you hear there is a public that wants to be heard and feels as if they are being heard through him.
Amanda, what does Bailey's win say about the direction of the Republican Party in Illinois?
Well, it's not just him. It is also DeVore, who we just heard from, various candidates in state legislative races who won their primaries against more moderate establishment and incumbent lawmakers. Some of these individuals were those who Bailey had endorsed. He has been very critical of the current leadership, the current Republican, all leadership, frankly. Democrats, of course, control it, but also the Republican leadership of the General Assembly. And that's how he got into the Illinois House. There had been somebody long thought of as a conservative who ended up breaking that budget stalemate back when Rauner was governor. That's Southern Illinois former Representative David Rice, had been seen as super conservative. And Bailey said, oh, no, not enough. No tax increases. So this is an indication that the Republican Party, the establishment, is a changing, particularly if Bailey has his way. And if you read into some of what he's been saying publicly, it seems as if he's going to be trying to make a bid for that.
And those establishment Republicans, Amanda, privately feel like, well, you thought we were in the wilderness in this state. Now we're really going to be in the wilderness because it just doesn't tack with how this state has voted for many decades. But then that conservative wing of the party, the Darren Bailey wing, let's call it, says, you know what, we tried your way for decades, and what did it really get us? So let's try this way. And that's the tug of war happening.
So, Heather, I want to get you in here. You know, we just heard Darren Bailey in that soundbite say that, you know, the elites and the press have discounted him for the general election. But does he have a realistic hope against Pritzker in November, who, as we've discussed, Pritzker has very deep pockets and the benefit of incumbency?
Well, it's not going to be an easy task. And I think a lot of people are looking at the results of the 2020 election to sort of give a benchmark for this. Donald Trump lost Illinois by 17 points. So that is not a small margin. And you would have to assume that the former president would have more name recognition, more money, a bigger campaign operation than Darren Bailey. So that is a huge margin to make up in just the next couple of months. But if there's anything we've learned in the last, decade, it seems like, is that elections are crazy. Anything can happen. And Pritzker chose this battle, and now he has to fight it. And there will be a lot of pressure on him to make good on really this chosen battle that he has ahead of him.
Okay, so talking about the Secretary of State race, Alexei Giannoulias emerged from a four-candidate field in the Democratic primary to replace longtime Secretary of State Jesse White, who's retiring. He faces Republican Dan Brady in November. Now, we know that White held this position for more than 20 years, but Giannoulias has a bit of baggage, Heather. How do you see this race?
It sure does, and it should prove that there are definitely second acts in American politics. Alexei Giannoulias, of course, lost a Senate race to Mark Kirk, but now he is back again running for statewide office, and we are going to hear a lot, I imagine, about his ties to former Governor Rod Blagojevich, who was, of course, convicted of a host of corruption charges, as well as his ties to his family's bank, which really sort of came into play in his race with Kirk. Now, I'm sure he will say, that's ancient history. I have moved on. Let's focus on the future. But there was not a whole lot in this primary about what he would do as Secretary of State. So we will be asking those questions and trying to see how he would use this incredibly powerful office and how he would operate it for the people of Illinois.
So Democratic incumbent Kwame Raoul, who was unopposed in the primary, of course, for his current job of Illinois Attorney General, he is going to take on the self-styled people's attorney, Tom DeVore, who we just heard from Amanda. You previously reported that the Democrats were trying to prop up DeVore's candidacy. Is there any chance that this could come back to bite the Democrats? You know, sort of a be careful what you wish for. Or could, you know, could DeVore actually end up mounting a serious challenge to Raoul?
Right. So this is very similar to what happened with the Democrats pushing Bailey. And we'll continue to ask that question. Is this going to backfire? And what will that mean for the agenda that Democrats have used their control of state government to buttress and put forward if it does become Governor Bailey or Attorney General DeVore? Right now, as with, by the way, the Secretary of State's race, there is quite a financial imbalance. Raoul has more than $1 million in the bank, whereas DeVore has about $35,000. The bulk of which was donated from his own pockets as a loan. So there certainly is a tough road for DeVore to get out there. And again, I think you're going to see Democrats making the argument, the very one that they did in the primary that helped boost DeVore over a Ken Griffin-backed candidate, Steve Kim, that he's too conservative for Illinois.
All right. In the race for U.S. Senate, Republican Kathy Salvey emerged from a crowded field to win the GOP primary and will face incumbent Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth. Harris, is there anything to suggest that Salvey could cause an upset in November?
Well, that Salvey name is familiar to longtime observers in politics in Illinois. Her husband, Al Salvey, ran unsuccessfully for senator against Durbin back in the 90s, and then also for Secretary of State unsuccessfully against Jesse White, who is now retiring. He was an Illinois state rep. He's a lawyer. Kathy Salvey as well is a lawyer, a very well-known and highly regarded lawyers out there in the western and northwest suburbs. And Salvey has basically said she is a conservative. She's pro-life, but she's the kind of conservative that will reach across the aisle and try to work with the other side. So not maybe not trying to brand herself like a Mary Miller, per se. You haven't seen Duckworth say a whole lot. You haven't really seen her up on the air with a bunch of ads, which suggests she doesn't think that this is a hugely competitive race right now. But again, as we've all been saying, the theme here is let's not assume anything, and that could change now in the next several months.
So, of course, there were congressional races last night as well, Heather. And, you know, beyond the individual candidates themselves, are there any themes that you think stand out, or what races do you think folks need to be paying attention to?
Well, I think the outcome of the first district race, where Jonathan Jackson is poised to secede Bobby Rush, he will face his Republican challenger in the general election. Last I checked, that race was too close to call. But Jonathan Jackson, along with Delia Ramirez, who won the nomination in the third district race, were both endorsed by the city and the county's progressive groups. And they won those races on a strategy of focusing on those progressive issues and not shying away from those issues. And I think the margin of those victories was surprising to me, and I think it was surprising to others. And I think that it will have significant ramifications as people start to catch their breath after the late night last night and look towards the 2023 municipal elections, where we have the bulk of candidates preparing to challenge Mayor Lightfoot coming at her from the right. I think these victories, especially Delia Ramirez's, will invigorate the city's progressives, and we will see more activity on that side of the political landscape.
I should say it wasn't exactly a sweep, though, for the I mean, they did well in several races, but if you look at the 6th congressional district, Sean Kasten, who is a liberal, a traditional Democrat, he won pretty handily over Marie Newman, and then Danny Davis in the 7th district beat back that challenge from Keena Collins, although she did mount a big challenge. I think it came down to like whether the more progressive side of the party versus the more establishment side won kind of had a lot to do with the district they're in. So Kasten makes a little more sense in the suburban district he's in. Delia Ramirez, perhaps, northwest side of Chicago, heavily Latino, maybe makes a little more sense in that district. It came down to the district, what's the best fit for the district, and who had the most resources.
And sort of the opposite when you look to some of the Republican primaries, of course. So one columnist described this as the hollowing out of the center, and that is what we saw in a lot of them. Of course, Paris is right. Individual, you can't necessarily make generalizations, but we do look for trends. So, you know, you take Kasten versus Newman. Part of it is the actual shape of the district, Newman in ethics investigation and such. But part of this truly is the way that the districts were drawn to be either more Democrat or more Republican. Again, you're seeing kind of the polarization that is by literal design in cases. And again, downstate, Miller, we talked a lot about this, won over Rodney Davis. Both certainly conservatives, but Davis, not so much as Miller.
So we've got to talk about national politics a little bit, please, because the November elections are going to take place, of course, within the context of these January 6th hearings, which have, according to the testimony we saw yesterday, have shown President Trump to have been unhinged on January 6th. Paris, any sign that this explosive testimony would change the opinions of any Trump Republicans?
I think there are a few signs. The signs that there are more explosive revelations to come in the January 6th hearings. And there are signs that it may not have soured some of the Trump base on Trump. We've seen over the last several years everything that happened, like, well, this will do it. They're not going to support him after this. But it hasn't been the case. So we probably should assume that this will sour the hardcore base. But there are rumblings among some of Trump supporters that this stuff will damage him in general, and that might make him a weaker candidate in 2024. And so perhaps they might have to move their support as a result of that. So in that sense, these hearings seem to have made an impact up to this point.
And Heather, you know, we've got about 30 seconds left, but, you know, between the hearings and, of course, the Supreme Court ruling about Roe versus Wade, can the Democrats, can they galvanize a base to avoid the so-called shellacking in November?
Well, that is certainly what they are hoping for, and they are casting this election truly in apocalyptic terms, because if the GOP seizes control of the House, there have been several members who've said they will introduce a national ban on abortion, and if the GOP wins back control of the Senate, that could certainly advance. Now, that means there will be more pressure on the 2024 presidential election, because President Joe Biden has said he would not sign such a ban, but it means that abortion is going to be front and center in many of these races. And, you know, it's the theme tonight. We don't have a crystal ball. It's impossible to predict how all of these issues will play out and how they will interact in other issues. But whenever you are, as a political party, hoping something goes wrong for the other side or right for you, you got to be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, we'll have lots to talk about in 5 months then. That's Spotlight Politics. Amanda Vinicky, Paris Schutz, Heather Sharone. Thanks, gang. Up next, a break from politics and a look at some art based on iconic Chicago images. But first, a look at the weather.
Contemporary artist is thanking Chicago in a new portrait series highlighting some of the city's most beloved icons. Arts correspondent Angel Ito shares just how good Chicago can look on just about anyone.
Whether it be catching the wind on the Centennial Wheel at Navy Pier or dancing to the hums of water splashing in Buckingham Fountain, contemporary artist Paul Brouwerman is eager to pay tribute to a city he's called home for the last 30 years with some of his favorite icons.
This is really just meant to be a small reminder that there's a lot of fun to be had in this city.
It was after creating a portrait honoring the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg that Chicago's Pinstripes restaurant reached out to Brouwerman to create a similar piece that utilized his detail with oil paints, only this time honoring the Windy City.
Given everything in the context of what Chicago's challenges are right now, I think we need every possible nudge to look at the positives. I really wanted to bring that to life as symbols of pride. And the idea is you can wear it proudly. And so the title of the series is Chicago Looks Good on You.
The portrait series features mural prints of Browerman's oil paintings with Chicagoans wearing, well, Chicago.
Before I moved to Chicago, I had put a picture of the Hancock Building on my refrigerator as a symbol of my goal. And I felt that Chicago was an accessible city back then. And so for me, my personal connection to all of these icons and to the city is to really celebrate that accessibility. We all have a personal connection with these landmarks. If you think about when you're on the Ferris wheel looking back at the city, the Centennial Wheel, you know, you're interacting with the city. When you're experiencing Cloudgate, you're actually seeing your reflection in context of the city. And really making these statements, these portraits, are about how each of us sort of owns these in our own way.
Now, Browerman says it took him 60 hours to complete portraits of Chicago icons like the Buckingham Fountain, but it was an idea years in the making.
The whole series took almost 2 years. I use a brush to kind of build in the sketch initially, and then I build a ground layer of a thin layer, and then I start adding in thick impasto layers of oil and using a palette knife mainly. So it allows me to stay free and expressive.
Browerman says he wanted his celebration of the city to be as accessible as these icons, which is why they'll stand in River East for the foreseeable future.
Whether it's your first time or your 21st time, these icons always create new experiences.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
And again, those murals can be found outside Pinstripes Restaurant downtown on Illinois Street. This is just the first of many series Browerman has planned as he continues to pay tribute to his favorite city and all of ours. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Please join us tomorrow night live at 7. And now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Paris Schutz.
And I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a proud sponsor of diversity, equity, and inclusion-focused free continuing legal education for lawyers throughout the region.